Yarok Larsen from Linköping University. Yarok is especially well known for his work on tensor efficiency loopholes in Bell's inequalities. So his work was sort of the basic reference in that field, and he was recently one of the co-authors on the loophole-free experiment and more recently he's become interested. He got interested in Hooke-Specker type theorems, and that led him to this. So today he's going to talk about quantum computation and the additional degrees of freedom in a physical system.
Yeah. Post to turn on the equipment.
So welcome. I know this is an Institute of Theoretical Physics, but I usually just send around one of these. That's a C-naught gate, a simulation of a C-naught gate in the sort of simulation framework I'm going to show you. It behaves almost like a quantum C-naught gate, but not entirely. I'm using it on the board, so you can't see it because it's too dark and too small. But on the board, I've actually set up the Deutsch algorithm. It says Deutsch-Jorsa, but Deutsch algorithm is the instance of Deutsch-Jorsa's problem, where you have one bit input functions, and you want to determine whether the function, UF, is constant or balanced. And I'll get to all of that. And it's actually running. So if you could read the measurement, it would tell you that this is a balanced function.
What's it actually doing?
The input qubit is on the top.
Okay.
Yeah. And a balanced function is either copy the input to the output or copy the inverse of the input to the output. That's a balanced function with one input. A constant function would give you the same value either way, right? So what this does is basically it checks if there's a C-naught here or not. If there is a C-naught present, you might say. And I'll tell you how this works in what comes. Niklas here is my student. So we came to this because we were interested in what makes a quantum computer tick, what makes it work. And we were looking through the references, and there are many things that are proposed resources. And of course, coming from Bell inequalities, I was thinking, well, maybe not non-locality, maybe the behavior that you get from quantum contextuality might be interesting here. So that would be my favorite resource, my entry point into this. Culprits, superposition and interference is the standard thing, the first one you end up thinking about, but I thought this was interesting. People also talk about entanglement or continuity of quantum state space, but I'll just tell you up front what we found. We found that contextuality didn't play a role, at least in the simplest ones, like the simplest algorithms, like the Deutsch-Jorsa algorithm. What we instead found was that the additional degree of freedom that you have available in these systems is the important thing. You can read and write into the additional degree of freedom. And this is what you do here. You write into the additional degree of freedom, in this case, phase. And then you read from the additional degree of freedom. You read from phase. And I'll tell you why we believe this is at least the entry point into how you could understand quantum computers better. It's not just superposition, which is sort of magic. You interfold waves. No, no, no. You write something into the face, and then you read something from the face. And that's basically what I'm going to tell you. Yes?
I'm just curious, that, given your conclusion, I assume by quantum computational speedup, you include the Deutsch-Jose algorithm as an instance.
That's true.
Would you have the same conclusion if I define quantum computational speedup a bit more strictly as, you know, computational, in terms of like computational complexity classes?
I will try and make that connection. So I'll answer your question in the talk. And actually, I'll make specific statements about what you can say and what you shouldn't do, what comparisons you shouldn't do. Because I haven't told you anything yet, so let's just continue. So usually in computing, you think about Turing machines. You have a work tape that goes into a finite state machine, and you get an output from that. Typically, when you look at a gate array, what you see is you put in some input information, you calculate the function, and you get the output. So this is the standard picture that you see in computing. Computer engineering, I should say. Now, if you talk about reversible computing, in Turing machines, you talk about a three-tape machine. So you have a finite state machine, and you've got three tapes, one with the input, one that carries a log of what you've done in the computation, and one which is the output. You copy the output onto. And in reversible computing, in gate form, you see this kind of picture. You have an input, which stays constant, and then you write the output onto a target. Now, as you can see, there's a discrepancy here. There's an input and an output, but the work tape doesn't seem to be here. Okay, so this is actually the correct, more complete picture. What you do is you take your two empty tapes. So here's the time point. You have your input to your function, and then you run your function, and you get some work log. The input stays the same, of course. The read head will have moved, and the output will have been written onto the output. Yeah, simple enough. Typically, you build reversible gates using something called Bennett's trick, or sometimes you see the terminology uncomputation. Yeah? So you run your three-tape machine, then you copy your output onto a fourth tape, and then you invert the function. So this is central to classical and quantum reversible computation. This is typically what you see in your constructions. You erase, you run it backwards. Suddenly you've got just the input and the output and nothing on the work tape. Ancillary bits in this case, because it's still in the language of reversible computation. In quantum computation, we think like this. Okay, so these are quantum states, you run your unitary, you get an ancillary state here that you then delete, and you retain just your output. So that's quite simple so far. And this is equally valid in reversible computing or in quantum computing. So the reversible computing is from the 70s, basically. Because people were thinking, okay, so there's a cost associated with running a computation, a fundamental cost. And this is a way of getting around that, because when you lose, typically you're only interested in the input value and the function value, not the work. If you forget that, if you erase, then you lose information. Landauer's principle. So people studied Landauer's principle and came up with this construction. And this is sometimes, not always, but sometimes used in quantum computing too. So you hear a lot about how to uncompute functions. Okay, so in quantum computing, we often see this kind of unitary, where you calculate the function, but you don't see any trace of these intermediate things. Well, I should tell you that this is unitarily equivalent to that. And it's not immediately clear, but if I do this, ancillary qubits, you write the work log and the function result, and then you erase it by uncomputing, you can see that the outer box here gives you a unitary equivalence. Fine. All of this is fairly trivial. At this point, let's just look at the standard explanation of what goes on here. If we look at the Deutsch-Ose algorithm, and now I should explain what goes on here. You have an unknown unitary that calculates the function. Your task is to find whether the function is balanced or constant with as few calls to the function as possible. Deutsch's algorithm does this in just one call. If you want to do it in a classical machine, you need two. And the typical way to do this is to input a zero and then have a Hadamard here, because then you get a superposition of zero and one on the input. Then you do a one here, because that gives you a superposition of zero minus one on the target. When you perform the unitary now, this minus sign will get written into the face here. So when you do a Hadamard, you will see not a zero, but you will see a one in Deutsch's algorithm. And that tells you that there's a balanced function here. If there's a constant function, then the face here will not be written into the control. So the standard explanation here is that you superpose all the possible input values. That's what you do with the Hadamard, right? You do the calculation in parallel for all of the inputs, and then you interfere these results at the end to give you the result. And what I'll argue is that this is not the correct explanation. It is some explanation of what goes on, but it's not the one that gives you the understanding of what's going on. Rob wants to ask something.
Just a clarification. It's
yes.
Been a long time since I've looked at the Deutsch algorithm. So is that U box, in the case where you just have one qubit, it's a controlled implementation of a balanced or constant unitary?
Yes. In the simplest case, when n here is 1, where you have the Deutsch algorithm, you have four different available functions. It's either a straight C0, which copies the input to the output, or it's a C0 followed by an inverter on the output, which copies the inverse value, so to speak, of the input to the output. The two other alternatives are constant functions, and then there's no C0 at all here. It's just a straight line through, or just an inverter. That gives you the constant functions. So these are the four choices that you have. One of them I've realized here, the C0 itself.
It is constant or balanced on the two qubits, not on the one qubit.
No, it's the function output is written here on that, and the function input is the top one. So it's one bit as input and one bit as output. Yeah. If you've got a larger instance of the Deutsch-Ose algorithm, what you increase is the input. The output is always one bit, because it's from n bits to one bit.
Okay.
And if you've got two bits in here, the output for a balanced function will be one for two of the input values and zero for the other two of the input values. So it's balanced, so to speak. If it's constant, of course, it's zero for all four possible values of the input. Was that clear?
So yeah, you can put that for the constant function at the top wire on the left and the bottom wire on the right. That's kind of what I was...
Yeah, so the input is here, untouched, so to speak, by the calculation, and the output is just one bit where you write the output on.
The output is just the parity of the function, right?
No, it's not the parity. If you've got one or two-bit inputs, it's a parity. But if you've got three-bit inputs, it's more complicated to describe. It's not straight up a parity then.
It's you didn't like sweep anything under the rug, you're right.
Come again?
Like for Deutsch Joseph for classical, you have many, many classical inputs.
Yeah.
To the function.
If you've got one bit value in, then you need to check both to see if the output is different, so to speak. Yeah. If you've got four possible values, two bits, then you need to check three values to see, is this a constant function or is it a balanced function? If you've got three-bit inputs, then you've got eight different values to choose from, and you need to check five of them to be certain.
I just wanted to check to compute this quantum Markov if you only have to compute the classical one once. Like you can always define some big quantum Markov in a function f.
Yes.
Sweep in some polynomial or exponential number classical.
Now, the problem that you're given is you're given an unknown function implemented in your mode of calculation. So typically, you get a quantum oracle. And you're guaranteed that this is either a constant function or a balanced function. And your task is to find out which it is. Yeah. And for a classical oracle, you have to run through lots of combinations. In a quantum oracle, you only need to check it once. And it'll tell you the output. I'm asking, is this the right explanation, the standard explanation that you do calculations in parallel? Or is there a better explanation? And now I'm going to use the composite gate, I'm going to resolve it like this. Remember now that this is unitarily equivalent to what I just showed you. So all of this is still within quantum mechanics. Our questions here, is the standard explanation correct? Are the results computed in parallel? And is this the central property? Or is there some other central property of the calculation? I already told you upfront what I think is the answer here. The answer is you can use this, but it won't tell you all there is to say. And now just a brief reminder. Here's an identity from Nielsen and Chuang, which is it's an exercise. The kickback, the phase kickback identity. If you surround a C naught with Hadamard, it turns upside down. So if you've got this gate here, you can actually write down an equivalent gate by just adding Hadamard. The blue ones, or the gray ones if you're colorblind, are new. So I've just added two at the top, two on each side here, and one there. Okay? And now I can just collect them together. So I'll do that. I'll put four here, and then I'll collect these so that that's the inverse of this. And you can see this speaks to the kickback identity. While these things, what are those? Well, it seems there's a Hadamard transformation on the inputs. If you've got many bits here, it's a Walsh-Hadamard transform. On the output, it's just a Hadamard transformation, a single Hadamard. If I now absorb these Hadamards into that, and absorb these Hadamards into the function, what I'll end up with is actually some sort of transform function. I get the transform output here. But this thing turns upside down. Yeah. So the quantum algorithm contains the evaluation of transformed functions. Now, I haven't got any Hadamards anymore. So these are just writing into the register, then running it through the function, and then reading something off at the output. This information here, the number one I put at the target, is actually copied into the transformation, into the calculation, sorry. And I should remind you that these things are invertible. Meaning that if I send a zero in here and a zero in there, and something changes in the middle here, there should be a change on the output. But I know from my construction that these outputs will be zero. I know them beforehand. So there's no way other than changing the output. And in the simplest case, that's from a zero to a one. It has to be like that. It has to exit on the top. Simply by the reversibility of the function, the unitary in this case. It has to be like that. Because if it didn't change the output, then that information would be erased here, and it wouldn't be reversible. So apparently, I'm writing something into the transform, the other degree of freedom, the phase degree of freedom in this case, which changes the output so that I can see what happens. So it changes the output so that I can determine what properties this function has. This is the central property of quantum computation. That's my claim. Okay, so once we know this, we're writing something into the phase degree of freedom. I mean, this is true here also. These are unitarily equivalent. So I'm just writing it into the phase. Here I'm writing it into the phase. Here it's still in the computational basis, but at the Hadamard it shifts into the phase, and then it shifts out, and I can read it off. And at this point, it's pretty natural to look at a simulation of quantum mechanics that contains the computational basis and the phase degree of freedom. And of course, you here will have heard this before, I suppose. I don't know how much Rob talks about this these days. Not much. I heard it first time in Växjö in 2003 or something like that. Maybe four. Okay. And it took 3 years to publish, right? Yeah, it took a while. And I liked it a lot, so I picked it up again here. Each bin 1/2 system is associated with a 2-bit ontic state. It singles out a point in the phase space. And Rob usually has these boxes on a line. I like to write it like a phase space. So 0, 1, plus in the phase or minus in the phase. Each bin 1/2 measurement outcome is associated with an epistemic state that consists of two of these boxes. And the uncertainty relation is translated into a knowledge balance principle. If you measure one of the ontic bits, it randomizes the other. So if you check it, whether it's in plus or minus, then the two bits randomize. Sorry, the computational bit randomizes. That's what I'm supposed to say. And since this spoke to us, we sort of rewrote the rules in a different language, is the same rules as in SPECINT in your model. Each quantum bit corresponds to a simplified model with two classical bits. The blue one is the computational basis, the red one is the phase. Again, I apologize to colorblind people. Measurement, you measure the computational basis, you randomize the other. A Z gate inverts the phase. It's a phase inverter. An X gate is a standard inverter. A Hadamard just switches the two. And you can do an S gate also, it looks like that. A C note, importantly, does a classical reversible logic C note on the computational basis, and a phase kickback is built in immediately. And it's a nice graphical representation of the model. So this looks neat. We have almost everything we need. And here, that's actually the gates. So these are implemented exactly like that. It has many funny properties from quantum mechanics, but it lacks some of them. Importantly, it doesn't have a quantum computational speedup. This list is from your paper, basically. It doesn't have contextuality. It's a local model. It doesn't have a continuum of states. My question was, what happens if we add contextuality to this model? Do we gain some speed up? I didn't expect it to give speed up everywhere, but it would be fun to just check what happens. So we start looking at this. We add a bit to the model. We rewrote the model into the language of Mealy machines, and then we extended the Mealy machine to include Peres-Mermin square contextuality. I won't tell you what it is. It's a type of contextuality you find in a quantum system consisting of two qubits. And we just said, what happens? So the Peres-Mermin square, one of them, there are 10, you need one extra bit. So there's a lower bound. The knowledge balance principle becomes a knowledge imbalance principle, unfortunately, because there's always more knowledge one lacks than knowledge one has. A student of mine looked at small systems and made some upper bound. He constructed explicit models that contained all of the 10 Peres-Mermin squares. Later on, a few people here found that a full simulation needs at least quadratically many bits. Yeah. And just recently, there's an explicit model for n bits, which gives you the full behavior of stabilizer quantum mechanics. The model has some properties, and you need quadratically many bits, more bits than here, but they also improve this lower bound. Interestingly, if you put n equals 2 here, you recover 5, what we had in the beginning. So probably this is a bit on the shy end of an actual estimate. On the other hand, the difference here is not that large. And I think this is a really neat result. Okay, so what did we do? When we started here, we only had the model that we had, in the first paper. But I just told the student, try this. Let's see. We've added contextuality and actually non-locality, because the model is now explicitly non-local. We might make it non-physical, but then again, these things happen in a machine which is localized. So maybe that's not so big a deficit. Our question was, do we get a quantum computational speedup? And the task I gave was try to do Deutsch-Ursa. for specifically for 3-bit inputs. Yeah. Why 3? Well, 1- and 2-bit input function oracles are in the Clifford group, and you can actually do them with Rob's model immediately. I've just done one here, and I don't have CNOTs enough to do all the 2-bit input functions, but you only need 3 of them. So it works fine. 3-bit input functions are not in the stabilizer group. So it's actually not Clifford gates, for those of you who understand. So you need something larger. You need more gates than we have available out of the box. To my amazement, he came back 4 weeks later and said, I don't need contextuality. 3-bit input oracles can be realized if I just add this simple trivial gate. I just ignore the phase. And now I can do 3-bit inputs. And I said, that's neat. But you still have some time before you need to present your thesis, so why don't you do 4? And he came back, oh, look, I can do any size input. And at this point you go, what? Because there's supposed to be a difference here between quantum and classical. And this is, I mean, it's a classical simulation of a quantum system. So you're thinking, what is going on? Have we misunderstood something? And then we look at what's going on inside the model here. So what we did was to actually be able to realize the functions, we needed to specify how do we implement the function. We needed to give an explicit proof that the function oracle does exist within the model. So what we did was you take a random permutation and then you copy the lowest significant bit to the target, and then you invert the permutation. If you have a constant function, you need to remove this C naught. And what happens in our simulation? Well, the permutation, since we build it out of these topologies that don't touch the phase, nothing happens to the phase, it's just computational basis states that are permuted. You can see the Hadamards are the crossings here. Then you've got this permutation, then you've got the C naught, and then you've got inverse permutation, and then Hadamards again. And if I just draw the way the information flows here, you write the information into the computation basis, then it shifts into the phase basis. It gets copied into the calculation, and now you see the connection to what I showed you before. So this is in our model, but what I showed you before is in quantum mechanics. It's the same mechanism. And that's really where we saw that, okay, so this is what goes on here. You copy information into the calculation. Interestingly, this gives you the right answer after one function call, irrespective of the size. And the overhead is constant. It's a factor 2 with respect to the quantum. Yeah. Yes?
So I'm worried that the fact that the oracle needs to include a C naught where there is because the oracle.
Correct.
Yeah.
This was our worry too. And then we realized, oops. Ah, yeah. The dotted line here is actually, it covers. I didn't draw that. So what you get in all of these situations is that you obtain, somebody gives you a box and tells you, this is in your computation model, it's a function that gives you a constant or a balanced function, and your task is to determine which. And I'll get back to more intricate versions of this argument. So, but basically, you're getting a black box with the function implemented is actually the reason why this works. So actually, just get a box. You don't see whether it's a signal present or not. The only way for you is to use the inputs and the outputs. And this is because Deutsch OSA is an oracle problem. You're given a black box and you're allowed to use the inputs and the outputs to determine the properties of the function. I'll return to this question soon. And we tried to publish this. And people didn't like, in particular, that point. Yeah. So we said to ourselves, so how do we explain it better? It really is this. It's just that in a quantum machine where you don't see this, you're guaranteed that the information here will be written onto the inputs in exactly the same way as here. It's just, it's not so clear from the quantum formalism that this is what you are guaranteed. I'll return to that, where this comes into the quantum formalism. At this point, the main objection from people was that there's no separation in any way between Deutsch OSA in a classical setting and Deutsch OSA in a quantum setting, because if you allow a random input in a classical machine, you need 3-4 calls, and then you know with high probability whether it's constant or balanced. So there's no separation. It's order one, both in the classical framework and in the quantum framework. So nobody cared. Okay, so let's look at something where there is a separation theorem. Simon's algorithm. And now it's harder to explain what it does. The function is guaranteed now to have the property that the output is equal if the input differs by a secret bit string. So if x and y are equal except for this extra bit string s, then the function values are equal. The task is to determine whether s is zero or not. So whether the function is 2-1 or 1-1. If you want, you can at the same expense of effort find this. So you can find the secret function. You do need an exponential number of classical function calls now, even with randomness. There's a theorem that tells you that you need exponentially many calls. But you need linearly many quantum oracle calls. And it turns out that our framework also finds S in linearly many function calls. Given that you're guaranteed the correct phase map here in your setup, it just works. The reason is that you don't write into the phase here any value. What you do is randomize at the source, basically. So there's a random phase being copied here. And you can show this in quantum mechanics, like I did. There is a random phase being written into the phase of the input registers. It works exactly the same in quantum and in the quantum simulation logic that we've produced. Isn't that neat? There's a separation theorem, but still a classical machine can simulate. Oh, come on, this should be impossible. There's a theorem. And this is the actual theorem. I've copied it from Simon's paper in 97. And I won't read all of it, but it just says that if you have a function from bits to bits, then you need exponentially many calls to have exponentially or to have a small error probability, even if you randomize the inputs. The important point here is that the function goes from bit strings to bit strings. which is why it doesn't work for quantum mechanics, because the function in a quantum setting is not from bit strings to bit strings, it's a function from quantum bits to quantum bits, quantum bit strings to quantum bit strings. In our case, it's a function from these complicated systems, two-dimensional things that we've entered into, to other two-dimensional systems. So, simply put, there's room to put more information here and read out more, or other information than we started out with. So the theorem, it doesn't fail. The proof is correct. It's just that it doesn't apply. Bell once said, I believe, that an impossibility theorem is only a sign of little imagination, lack of imagination. You need to imagine something that violates this in a natural way, like, okay, quantum bits to quantum bits. Do some other change and see what happens. Still with the same Toffoli, which ignores the phase. Now, people then start to complain, what if I give you the function as a reversible gate array, what will happen then? Well, in most cases, the simulation will work, but not always. You're not guaranteed. And I'll show you exactly why. Okay, so yeah, our Toffoli gives systematic errors. It's not an exact thing. It gives you the wrong phase map. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes. The upshot here is that you're outside the oracle paradigm. If you resolve the gate array, then the gate array I gave you for Deutsch OSA, you can simply check whether there's a C0, or if there's no C0, and you know if it's a balanced function or not. And you don't need to call the function ever anytime. You can just do it. So this is really, how many times do you need to call the function? Also, there are slightly too many functions. It's not possible to transfer exponentially much information in polynomial time. So there is a problem there too. In these two cases, there's too much information to transfer. Nowadays we use this as a map for our Toffoli, so it doesn't ignore the phase anymore. It still gives you systematic errors, but it's much, much better. If you wonder why this map looks like this, it's basically a controlled C0, symmetric over the three things. And if you do that, then, for example, this gate array will work. And you can see it's not the simple gate array that I showed you before. Superposition is actually not a good explanation. Typically, you see that the people tell you that there's a unitary that gives you the correct function value. And that's all. It's unitary and it gives you the correct function value. That's not correct. You need to preserve the phase. If you put this function here, which incidentally gives you the same function map, yeah, but the wrong phases, and you run the algorithm by putting Hadamard at the front here, the top one will give you the correct combination, but the bottom one will give you nothing on the output. It looked like nothing happened, irrespective of which function it is. Meaning that I won't see anything on the output here. It'll give you the correct results here, but this one will always answer constant. All the input values are still superimposed. But the algorithm will just fail out of the blue. And it's worse I've just done one here, but there are exponentially many different ones that failed. There's only one that gives you the correct answer. So the hard part when you construct a quantum computer is not getting the function map to be unitary. It's getting the function map to be the correct unitary that preserves the phase. This is really important. This is really important. This phase requirement, that's what shows up as a structural requirement. That's why the CNOT has to be in that place in QSL, because it's a more restricted model. It's a simpler simulation. It's not quantum mechanics, so there will be a different requirement. But this is really important, that you need the correct unitary. In our sense of the word, what happens here is that you write as the number one into the phase, but then the phase inverter just zeroes out, and nothing gets written into the phase of the top system. So it's completely immediate if you look at it from that point of view. Okay, let's do something fun now. Let's look at Shor's algorithm. What about Shor's algorithm? Can we run Shor's algorithm? That would be fun. You find the period of the exponential mod n. N is the number you want to factor. The classical algorithm that corresponds to this setup is exponential, but the best known classical algorithm is actually sub-exponential. That's a third root in the exponent. The quantum algorithm is cubic polynomial. And if you don't compile the circuitry, simplify extensively, even factoring 15 is outside the Clifford group. So we need the Toffoli that we construct. And if you just do the same sort of map that I showed before, you'll end up finding that there's a random phase being written into the top system, and that's what you read off when you do Shor's algorithm. And the thing you read off here will give you the period of this exponent, and that helps you to factor. And this you can do now with that sort of thing. So here's a multiplication with 4 mod 15, these two. That's a Fredkin gate, a controlled swap. And this is multiplication with 2 mod 15. The inputs are on the top, and you've got the inverse Fourier transform. It reduces to 3 gates when you have 2-bit inputs. This is a realization of a setup from a science paper from 2015. And I should tell you that in our implementation, there are systematic errors because the Toffoli is not perfect. Interestingly, the errors are on par with that experiment from 2015. So the errors are here. That should be even over the 4 alternatives. This should be even over the 4 alternatives, and that should be even over the 4 alternatives. And that's actually data, so it's 1,000,000 points for each experiment, each setup. The asymptotic behavior, well, it's number theory. So it jumps around, and it depends heavily on the numbers involved. Here you actually get the same probability of success as you do in the standard quantum mechanical setup, but that's a fluke. 15 is actually a degenerate case, and if you're interested, I'll tell you the math, but after. You shouldn't do 15 in experiment, because that's simple. You should do 21 or 35 or something. Grover's algorithm. Find x so that the output is 1. You have a database question implemented here. The classical algorithm is exponential. The quantum algorithm, you have the square root. And the quantum algorithm here, you still write something into the control, but you then perform error correction using the Grover iteration, the Grover inverse over the mean. And you're tired, so I won't bore you with the details. In our case, we can of course do the same sort of motions with the simulation, and the question is, what happens? Well, it seems that it's still an error correction here, but if you repeat like you do in Grover, it rotates back. So somehow it error corrects a little too far, and then it jumps back across the correct value. So if we do this one shot, interestingly, it's actually better than classical. Not that much, but it is. So order 2 to the exponent n divided by n. So in layman's term, it's a logarithmic advantage, basically, in terms of n, which is neat. There's an advantage, but it's not all the way to the quantum value. And you could discuss the reasons for this at length, but still, there is some. I think this is neat. So it's for 2-bit inputs, it works out of the box. For 3-bit inputs, it's actually quite slightly better than the quantum, and then it grows worse. And you all seem shocked. I don't know how to interpret that. Perhaps you're just tired. So I'll conclude. Quantum algorithms realize the evaluation of transform functions. That's what you implement when you implement a quantum function. You implement the forward function as the function calculation, and the kickback map is a transform function that tells you something about the structure of the function. The forward map tells you the values. The backward map, the kickback, tells you something structural. The target system information in the face serves as input in the valuation of the transform function. And it has to influence the control. There's no way out. This additional degree of freedom that you use in your calculation, you can use to your benefit. It reveals structure. If you want to formulate a separation theorem, you need to take care, because for a separation theorem to be interesting, it has to separate QSL and quantum, not classical and quantum. I think the valid comparison is actually between quantum and QSL, not quantum and classical. Because the classical function is so restricted, so that there's no way you can beat. It's not so much about calculational advantage. It's more about communication. What can you extract from the function? If you've got this face, like in QSL, then you suddenly can extract more information. You can choose by doing the Hadamard. You can choose to reveal other information than the function value. So the conclusion is superposition and interference are not the resources that you're looking for. Thank you very much. Yes?
The Oracle?
Yes.
Could you explain what that does exactly?
In the Deutsche OSA,
yeah.
Right? Because the Oracle is built out of. Oops. The Oracle is the dash box. So this is just one way of implementing a balanced function. PyF, it randomizes the number states. In a quantum mechanical setting, it would randomize the number states. It doesn't randomize the input bits. That would be too restrictive. It randomizes the number states. And then you take one of the bits as your output that you copy onto the It's a random permutation. So if you've got eight states, three qubits.
The input state or the
sorry?
The input?
Yeah, the input, you say that you've got three input bits. Then you've got eight possible input states labeled 0 to 7. And it randomizes those. So if you get a 0 as an input, you might get 5 as an output. If you get 1 as an input, you might get 3 as an output. Yeah, so that kind of randomization.
So it randomizes the input?
Randomizes
the function.
Sorry?
And then it applies the function.
No, the function output is one of the bits of this randomized number sequence. So that's how you do it. Yeah, that's how you do it. So in principle, you could, it corresponds to taking all of your inputs to from 0 to 7 and then just taking a random bit for 4 of them. And the opposite value for 4 others. Yeah. Rob?
So I have a question about why you decided to that the conclusion of this analysis ought to be that the source of the computational speedup is not what we thought of.
No, it's...
So let me ask.
Yeah, okay.
Here's a kind of competing conclusion.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned to you before, I mean, back in 2004 or whenever, I realized that the toy theory could reproduce the Deutsch algorithm.
Yes.
And the lesson I took from that, which might be wrong, but this is my impression, was that all oracle problems, I was very skeptical of any claims about quantum advantages for oracle problems, because all oracle problems force you to make a comparison between some classical oracle and decide what's the corresponding quantum oracle. And it's not obvious, right? And so, you know, my conclusion for that was, okay, we have this, the thing that people call the quantum oracle that corresponds to this oracle that implements balanced or constant function. I said, no, that's a much better analogy from the classical side would have been an oracle that takes two bits of input and does exactly what the toy theory does. Like, so if you make that comparison, then, you know, there's no quantum advantage.
No.
So to my mind, it left me feeling like, well, just all claims about quantum advantages for oracle problems are kind of garbage, because every, you know, it all rests on the foundation of what you decided to call the quantum analog of a given oracle. And I guess you showed in your talk at some point that if people had decided to call, you know, the quantum oracle with constant and balanced functions something that just reproduced f of x in the computation basis, regardless of the phases, then, you know, they would have another choice of what the, you know, I thought that was a nice way of also seeing that there's lots of choice in what the quantum version of that possible
would be.
So that was kind of my takeaway. Schur's algorithm still finds it's not an oracle problem.
Exactly.
But all these other ones, I sort of felt like, well, claims about quantum advantages are just not a good idea. And you didn't make that your conclusion, so I'm kind of curious why you didn't go that route.
No, that's exactly what I was trying to argue. I'm agreeing with you 100%. The comparison is just bad. So that's what I was trying to say when I said you shouldn't compare quantum and classical. You should compare quantum and this quantum simulation logic. Because quantum and classical, you're restricting the classical oracle to such a degree that it really is impossible. This is why the separation theorems hold. They don't hold if you don't make this restriction that you only have bits as input and bits as output. So I agree with you 100%.
I'm not sure we do quite agree, because it sounds to me that you're saying there's a menu of possibilities over on the classical side. There's sort of the usual classical oracle, and then there's the particular kinds of oracles you're talking about in your models.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like you're saying, don't make the comparison between the quantum oracle and what people usually, instead compare to this other thing.
Yes.
Whereas the kind of conclusion I was going for was just the fact that there are multiple possibilities means that these are not meaningful comparisons. It's not like we have to get the comparison right. But
no, no, no. I'm making the exact same argument. It's just that I've taken so much flack for this that I've decided to mitigate the argument by saying, here's something else you can compare with. I'm also on the side. Your argument is that these comparisons between quantum and classical are just not telling you anything interesting. Is that a good?
Well, the particular oracle.
Yeah, if you talk about black box,
yeah,
oracles, a black box quantum oracle and a black box classical oracle, the comparison is just not valid. This is your argument, I believe, and it's also my argument. You shouldn't compare these two at all. My argument is actually the quantum oracle is not a black box. You can glean information from the quantum oracle through the phase. So it's actually a side channel, a concept from cryptology, that you can use to your benefit. You can test the box in a different way, which isn't available to you for a classical black box oracle. You can send information in the phase and then read off information from the phase, and that will tell you something about the structure. A comparison to a classical cryptology case is when you have a chip that runs AES, the advanced encryption system. You don't know the key because that's hidden in the chip, but you want to get out the key. So what do? You can't just send messages and get it encrypted because that won't tell you that much. You need to send lots of messages. What do? You hook up an oscilloscope to the power, and then you read off the power consumption of the chip. And using some nifty tools from cryptology and some statistical analysis, you can extract the key from the power consumption. I know this because we set a master's thesis student to do exactly that. A modern chip, AES. Here's an oscilloscope, here's a chip. And he came back, not 4 weeks, but I think 6 or 7 weeks, and said that was too easy. So we needed to find him another task. That's also a side channel. And cryptology is full of these side channels. This is a side channel for quantum computing. You can extract information in ways that you cannot in a classical black box. And that's my argument. You've got more freedom. If you do understand quantum computing this way, that might actually help you to find new algorithms, because it's not this magical superposition anymore. Is there some structure I can find by doing this, by implementing it in a quantum machine? I think it's interesting.
There's another question.
Yes, so I was like still, so there's like C not in the middle. So okay, like from what I understand before, you had like the smaller dashed boxes were the oracles, and now you have enclosed it into one larger oracle.
Now these are building blocks. So you can think of this as the young computation I showed you before. So the function has input and output, and this is an intermediate step. Here you can read out the log from the work that you performed inside, and then you invert to erase that log of what you've done for what calculations you did.
I mean, like the problem still stands. Like if there's no C not in the middle, then like it's not a general balance function that you're computing, but just data.
No, so if there is a C naught, then it's a balanced function. If there is no C naught, then it's a constant function.
I mean, yes, it's balanced, but like because it's the identity, it's not like a generic balanced function.
No, if there's no C naught here, it's a constant function because you do nothing to the output.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a constant function.
Yeah, okay, so then basically like what you're comparing is like the function you're guaranteed that like it's either like the constant function or it's a
balanced function.
Constant function.
Yeah. Balanced function, yes. If you read the paper, let me just show you the reference there. If you read the paper, you can find that we've also done the, shall we call it, the original version of Deutsch and Jose's problem where you're not guaranteed that it's a constant or a balanced function. And then you actually need to use a comparator that compares two numbers. And then you don't have this structure where you have either a C naught or no C naught. You have a more complicated structure which is equal for all of the functions. But you need to read the paper to do that. But I mean, in that respect, the results hold in the Oracle paradigm where you only have a black box, so you can't look inside whether the C naught is there or not.
Okay, like we can also discuss a little bit.
We'll talk later, yeah, sure. Sure.
No more questions. Let's thank Jan-Åke. Thank you.